Hello, how are you?
I'm so excited to have this chitty chat with you.
It's been a minute, hasn't it?
It's been a minute. Thanks for joining me, friends. I have my dear spirited friend that I get to connect with every once a year, maybe since we've met. Marcel Hernandez from Nashville, Tennessee, right?
Originally from Texas, always Texan, but have been in Nashville for close to 25 years, so.
Well, thanks for coming on this beautiful podcast with me. I am excited to chat with you today for a lot of reasons. Marcel came into my life through the Trauma-Informed Educator Network conference, and I just feel so blessed that we got to connect because it was kind of a random connection, I think.
It was. I was able to join your session last minute, and very much enjoyed it. There was standing room only. I remember that.
Yeah,
And
it was sort of a wild group. So, as you know, I invited you on because I'm inviting guests who can contribute to brain development, mental health, trauma, who have some skin in the game. And so I want to talk a little bit about who you are and what you do, and then we're going to talk about why you do it.
Sure, that sounds great.
Yeah, so who are you? What do you do?
So I am Texan, like I said, first and foremost. I am a father of two young boys, 7 and 4. I'm a husband to my wife, Lindsay, and we have a home here in Nashville. And I work with youth and families in a couple different capacities. One is justice-involved youth. Through an organization called Be About Change that I founded in 2016, really heavy on programming and relationship building. And I'm also development director for an organization called Tucker's House, and we provide home modifications for families who have children with disabilities. And I am a lover of human beings and love to see bear witness to human beings on their journey and try to learn what I can along the way, as stubborn as I can be. By default, I think makes me a slow learner, but we persist nonetheless.
It's funny you say stubborn because all the stubborn people I know are passionate, and stubborn people make change. They get things done. And so I want to talk about both those lenses. I want to talk about the first one, be about change. Did I say that correctly?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, let's talk. How did that get started? Where did that come from? How did you get that off the ground? Because juvenile justice stuff is, it's its own lane,
Right, a
right?
little complicated. Yeah. So I got the idea in 2015. I was about a year into sobriety. I got sober in October of 2014 and hit kind of a wall, so to speak, psychologically. And through a series of kind of short-term events, ran a half marathon, was writing for a local newspaper, and had some conflicts there, and created the website, beaboutchange.org. Where I started with writing because I had an article that was rejected by the local newspaper, and being an artist, I got butt hurt, and just rather than wallow, I decided to start kind of self-publishing, and that quickly grew into higher education scholarships, programming in high schools, and then ultimately monthly workshops at the juvenile court, and then the longer term relationship, which allowed for us to start with 8-week programs. And now we have two main programs: Project Lead, which is a leadership program for about 12 to 18 year olds, and Reading Success, which is a literacy program for kindergarten and first grade. And have learned a ton along the way, of course, and some things that I might not have even anticipated when I first started. And officially founded the 501c3 in 2016, January 2016.
This is great. So it leads me down the question of why, right? People who are passionate about working with juveniles, teenagers in that work, I just wonder, I'm curious, Marcel, if there's a why in your own history of how you landed there. Talk about sobriety, you talk about these different pieces of your own life. Why this group of people?
When I was in fourth or fifth grade, I was hanging out with some friends. I lived across the street from my elementary school, and we were just, hanging out playing at the in the schoolyard. And one of my friends came up, and he was crying, And he had said that one of this kid that we knew in the sixth grade had gotten shot and killed down the street at his home. And that event was basically the first time I had seen violence kind of close in my closer circle. And then when I was in high school, that same friend who delivered the news was himself killed. I was probably sophomore or junior, and my girlfriend at the time delivered the news on a Saturday. We were headed to a football game, and that hit me pretty hard. And I'd known him since second grade. And then later on, another kid that I knew since kindergarten, this would have been probably 2002 or so, was killed as well. And a lot of the, I guess, conditions in those three events were conditions that you might see now in juvenile justice and poverty and all these different kind of environments and circumstances. And that was always in the back of my mind, is the powerlessness that I felt then, and how that ultimately led me to want to try to make a difference with individuals that seemed like my friends in childhood, but in the here and now. And one friend in particular that I grew up with, that I still talk with, former board member of Be About Change, he had encouraged me pretty early on after founding the organization to go down to the juvenile court, because he knew I had kind of an affinity for participating in these workshops. And he said, "Hey, there's a lot of work to be done there. I think you'll find that when you go introduce yourself." And that's what I ultimately did. And just, haven't looked back, and have built a ton of great relationships with the Nashville Juvenile Court, the leadership, probation officers, court administrators, and just the team that that is very invested from a of course relationship standpoint, but also from a just a heart perspective, I guess you could say, and just similar folks that have maybe similar stories or similar experiences that has led them in the kind of our common space to ideally impart what we know, but also learn from the youth participants on what they need in 2024, which is not so different from the 1990s, but there are obviously some differences.
So many questions. One question, what do youth need? What are you finding youth need in 2024?
The same thing that we as adults need, and I think that is strong, lasting relationships of support. And I find even in my peer circles, just yesterday I spoke with a friend who is going through a relationship conflict that I had no idea, because I hadn't spoken with that person in some time, and we talked about it. We connected on a totally separate topic. He's helping me analyze data, basically. But of course, we started with kind of a personal check-in type deal. And it seems very common that a lot of people suffer either in silence or isolation. And so as that happens in our peer circles, of course it happens in youth circles as well. And that piece, I believe, is timeless, in that we've always, in our human experience, needed quality relationships.
Love that. And love that for many reasons. One, connection and relationship is what regulates us. It's what gets us through the hard stuff, right? And I think it's one of the reasons you and I connected. You sat in on half of my session. I saw you as part of a panel, and there's an authenticity about our connection and knowing that we're these two people on this planet who just decide we're gonna impact in a different way. And part of what's happened in these chitty chats is that what I'm learning is these individuals who are doing extraordinary work, which I think Be About Change and what you're doing is extraordinary work. And we haven't even talked about Tucker's House. I can't wait to hold that thought. It starts from our own personal journey. And it starts from this layer of this happened to me. This is part of my story. And this is what I can do to change that. And so when you set out to go down to juvenile court, build these relationships, did you have any hesitation inside? Were there any parts of you that were like imposter syndrome? Do I belong here? Do I not belong here? How do you overcome that? Or were you just like, this is my purpose. I'm confident. I'm going to make this happen. I'm stubborn. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, so a bit of both. And the first, let's just say, less than handful of workshops, I took this approach as, kind of a rigid outline, let's say, for the discussion. And I found quickly that my rigidity was met with more rigidity, right? Who knew?
Weird.
And and so that forced me to become a better listener, become a better observer, and just try to be more of a facilitator rather than an actual speaker. And I think probably somewhat common is like a person like me who kind of walks into the space has this preconceived notion of what it ought to look like. And then the ego leads, right? And so I think that I led with this idea that I was going to impart all this wonderful wisdom being in recovery, right? I know everything now. And again, very youth type of approach. And quickly received an education that it was quite the opposite. And so any apprehension was more so on the unknown of what a juvenile court room might look like versus a typical high school room, where it's obviously the same. There's a Venn diagram between the individuals that are in the high school classroom and the juvenile court classroom. But of course, the juvenile court classroom are unwilling participants, by and large, near 100% of them are unwilling. And so it became this question of what can I do to be more engaging. To I have a mentor who said, don't go in with the idea of teaching concepts, go in with the idea of creating an environment of learning. And so I had to try to keep that in the back of my mind, and still do, right? Particularly when we don't know what a person is carrying with them into a given room. And then it becomes more of responding and then just knowing now different ways to engage. Maybe a bit of imposter syndrome, but at the onset, I was very determined to gain more and more repetitions so that I could then draw from that experience. And some quote unquote favorable, feeling fulfilled and all this stuff, and then some just feeling defeated. And the combination of all those experiences has led me to a place where I am now, when I walk into a room, it's not so much about my expectation, so much as what might be needed. So like in a religious way, one could say, allow the spirit to speak through me or to listen through me. And then also know that what we are doing with young people, more than anything, is cultivating here, like tilling the soil and allowing for ideally seeds to be planted in both directions. And from my experience, knowing that that vegetation might not grow until later in life, and that's okay.
Sure.
And that's kind of the way that I've approached it, and in some ways, totally ignorant at the beginning, and now slightly less ignorant.
It sounds like curiosity has been a huge gift for you. And the idea of being curious in these settings, being curious about the human experience, creating the learning environment is all about curiosity. And so, what I say to people when they are passionate about something is, how do you get in that space and be curious about it? And it sounds like the passion led you there. And then you've created these spaces where maybe a little less ignorant, but also seeing the value of that connection and relationship and how that adds to juveniles.
For sure. And I, funny enough, I personally struggle with maintaining curiosity more so with peers than I do with young people, because I have this, I guess, expectation that we ought to graduate mentally, in our way of thinking. And when I become less curious, it's because I forget where I came from, seemingly. And I have to really force myself to remember the grace that others extended to me when I was more of a know-it-all, let's say.
Yeah. Well, and that's the beauty of brain development, right? We can look at teenagers. I live with them now. They're in my home. And I can say, oh, I want that cortex and that frontal lobe to be more developed, and it's not yet.
Right.
Right? I can hold that more real time with my teenagers, but with adults, I can't do that as well. With adults, I'm like, you have a fully developed brain. You have a cortex. I have a
Right.
different expectation. And every time, 99% of the time, that's when I fall into like a place of disappointment with adults, is because I'm holding that expectation and I forget, oh, their amygdala might be hijacked. Oh, they're human. Oh, they've got a different stress response. Oh, it's activated. Like all the, they have different experiences. They don't know what I know, all these things. And it sounds like that's been a similar experience for you too.
As my dad says, I have this expectation when somebody is old enough to know better. And but you know, that's apparently there's not a correlation between age and maturity, if you want to call it that, and perhaps emotional intelligence. You know, and I guess for me, sobriety has really forced me to look at my prior level of low emotional intelligence. And you know, again, slightly more emotionally intelligent now. And yeah, I think you're right. It with adults, it's just more challenging for me.
Yeah. Well,
And that's
and I appreciate you speaking to the vulnerability of sobriety. That's a piece of your journey, I'm sure, and it adds a different insight to it, right?
it's very Jungian focused in terms of the psychology of it, which I love because I know that ultimately it's about the way that I respond to things and not any external words, actions, what have you. I mean, I have learned, of course, to pick up in human interaction on patterns. And so it's much easier for me at 44 now to recognize a behavioral pattern because I've seen it before. Like we've, at my age, I've probably seen the spectrum of human behavior. And now it's just whether or not I choose to project assumptions into those patterns when I see them, because we know that even though the pattern might be there, that I can now, knowing what I know, I can respond differently to it. And I don't have to just meet that energy, you know, where I perceive it to be.
Love that. Love that.
It's,
And go ahead.
I was gonna say, it's I know for me that I have to work on my level of patience and my ability to just be patient. And thankfully my children teach me every day.
Yeah, we're gonna circle back to your own house. So let's talk Tucker's house first, and then we'll come
Sure.
back to the home of the Hernandezes and how this
Perfect.
all applies. So tell me more about this Tucker's house.
So I w had the opportunity to join the organization in 2022. At the time, in fact, when you and I met, I was with a national nonprofit that also worked with justice-involved youth in a much more heavy way than Be About Change, because it was daily interactions in homes, in communities, that sort of thing. And it was just very draining because I would come home super stressed and, you know, I'd take it out on my family, right? And so I had the opportunity to connect with Tucker's House. I'm good friends with our executive director, Graham. Known him for, gosh, about 15, 16 years now through church, and play music together. And he actually also kind of co-presented with me in Be About Change at the Juvenile Court. So we got to know each other pretty well. And it's a development heavy role. I do some not specifically working with families, but there are family interactions, but it's more fundraising, relationship building, right? And so I knew from Be About Change and the national nonprofit that I wanted to gain more repetition specifically in development and fundraising because I was already trending that way anyway. And Tucker's House has really taught me a lot in terms of structuring an organization, building sustainability, creating processes, and just working with a team that is very focused on the sustainability piece, which I can then learn from and ideally pass on into the team at Be About Change. And then ultimately just knowing that Nashville is kind of a big city with a small town feel, or perhaps the opposite of that. And so, having lived here since the late 90s, of course, there's always going to be very few degrees of separation between anybody I might meet at any given moment. And so, learning these things. Tucker's House, really, there's a, from my perspective, a more tangible, measurable outcome on the program side, which is providing the home modifications, accessible home modifications, for these children with disabilities. And so it's that I'll contrast that from justice, involved youth programming, where the outcomes are, as we know, long term, they don't look so great.
Yeah.
And of course, the number one variable is the environment, particularly when a young person lives in poverty, and how we, whether from a resource program relationship standpoint, that's not a variable that is seen, it's seemingly insurmountable. And so, drawing from the program experience from Be About Change, the development experience, bringing it into Tucker's House, and then applying what I know in that way, and then doing the opposite. And so, for me personally, it's built a much more well-rounded knowledge of nonprofit relationships, different roles of relationships organizationally, as well as in the community, and then learning even the difference between private and public funding, everything that comes along with both of those, and the pros and cons of each. And just the confirmation that relationships are what sustain everything through time, even beyond when we're gone in this physical life. And so the ability to learn that through Tucker's House has been very meaningful, and has really shined light on me personally on areas where I need to grow from a leadership standpoint, and in many different ways, really, and has helped to inform the way that I communicate externally, which again, experience comes for me for like a ton of mistakes. And so being able to combine those mistakes with what I'm learning, sometimes actively, sometimes upon reflection, has been meaningful, because I now have enough information to know how to build a relationship where I might otherwise destroy it. Now, it's not to say that I'm successful all the time, but I'm more aware of it. And that's served me well, over, I'd say, the past year or so, in a few different ways.
That's really powerful. That's what there's so many pieces of this that are powerful. So I have a lot of questions. One question is, how much in both worlds do you see people putting energy towards intervention versus prevention? And how would that shift if we put more energy towards prevention than intervention?
I was trying to think about both at the same time, and I need to stop myself and try to think of one at a time. So, with Be About Change, and let's just say justice involved youth, I have been drawn to the area of literacy, particularly because of prevention and the relationship that there is academically between reading and math and adult incarceration and everything in between. And as we kind of talked about before, the ultimate variable is the environment, the home environment. And I haven't met a person or organization yet that has been able to meaningfully address the environmental piece. On the justice on in the space of justice involved in the space of justice involved youth, what I am starting to conclude, I think, is that the name of the program, like that isn't so important as the quality of relationships that are within the program, and that go beyond the length of the structure of the program. And so those quality relationships can be found in several different programs. And then there's some programs that, they're just poorly executed. And as humans, we tend to react a lot, right? And so I think that the actual preventative measures in the youth justice involved space is perhaps more about family intervention or prevention at the family level than just the young person themselves. And being a parent of young children and knowing how our time is limited, I have a much better perspective now than I did in 2016, 17, 18 of the common, oh, it's the parents, or where are the parents? Like it's I think our friend Matthew says it best, the parents are the experts in the child's life. And that's for better and for worse. And I have always found better or improved just outcomes in general when I am afforded the opportunity to build a relationship with a parent or family member or both. And if whether that's prevention or not, I don't know, because I can't quantify the value of that. I just know from personal experience on as a parent and as somebody who has relationships with their parents that allows for meaningful participation for the young person, because it's a leadership thing, right? So the parent is
Sure.
modeling for the young person sees that, and so
Sure.
they are more apt to engage. With that may not have fully answered the question, but it's
No,
my shot at it.
you're doing great. You're doing great. I think that's, go ahead. Now answer the,
Yeah,
yeah,
so
the
for
Tucker's
Tucker's
house question.
house, the thing I love about the program is that we start with a physical therapist so that the family's priorities can be heard
Yeah.
and actually witnessed and documented in the home. And so the our therapist team has found that any caregiver can perform up to 5,000 manual transfers in a given year. And you take that across, let's say, 40 years, you've got 200,000 manual transfers, which is difficult for the brain to comprehend. And the home modifications alleviate those transfers. And so the idea with the physical therapist is that we can then pass that information on to an architectural designer that creates the design informed by the family's priorities and then brought to life by the construction team. And so it creates a lifetime solution rather than one thing where we have to come back every 3 to 5 years. And so to me, knowing what I know from juvenile justice and generational impact and everything that comes along with that, it's awesome to see how something as seemingly simple as a zero entry shower, for example, can provide physical and emotional relief for a caregiver, which is then passed down to the young person, which, in some instances can then be passed down to a grandchild. So, when we're stressed out, our shoulders are up, we're stressed and we're antsy and we're anxious and we're like all these things. And even though we can't necessarily realize it over the course of a few short moments, over the course of 3 to 5 years, those shoulders kind of start to relax a little bit more. And we know that when we are, we can, when we're more relaxed, we can breathe deeper, we can breathe deeper, we can make better decisions, we make better decisions, we can care for others in sounder ways, and our children can see and experience that. And so there's a lot to be said about the ability to do that. And like for me, what I'm thinking now is like as a father, right? As we raise children, we are of course reliving our own childhood moments, and in some ways carrying positive things from those moments, and in other ways kind of going against the grain of what we know that was negative for us and trying to facilitate something better for our children. And so when I see parents able to then breathe deeper and make better decisions and how that impacts their children, that's meaningful to me because it's encouraging to bear witness to that. And then it's also a relatable point because I know that even though my children don't have physical disabilities, there's always a something or some things that we will wrestle with internally, and that will ultimately affect how we interact with the outside world. And so from a That's a whole, see if I can tie it all together, right? From a prevention standpoint, ideally what we're doing is preventing future psychological discomfort, or at the very least facilitating more comfort, because we have like a video series called House to Home, and the idea is that it's not just a place with trying to think of the cheesy phrase I've used before, which is a house is made of wood and beams, a home is made of love and dreams. And it is home, we know, is also here and here. And even as a father, I want my, I would say, number one goal is to build a strong home foundation here within my children, so that when they depart, they know they have a place to return to. Because sure shit, they will depart, right? As we all do. And so the ability to see how our community partners and just donors and everyone involved in this communal aspect of it really facilitate the long-term peace for people and for families and for households.
You did a great job of tying that all back together. And for our listeners who can't see your visuals, that piece of our home is created in the head and the heart is powerful. And the question I want to ask you is, I think the struggle for me in mental health and the work that I do is it's not tangible. Right? We don't often see the seeds that we've planted grow into something else. We're not sure what happens to people after they leave certain systems. We always have these question marks or these curiosities. But what is tangible is how I can bring what I've learned in my work into my home. And so my question for you is, what are those lessons that you've learned from the outside world that you bring into your home? Which I think you've talked a little bit about some of that, but how do you take what you professionally know and make it personal and live this work also?
In the exact same way that I do professionally, and that's through a series of small mistakes, small wins, big mistakes, big wins. And so I've always got, I'm cursed forever with the recovery, psychology, which I say that jokingly, because I think that to an extent with a 7 and a 4 year old, I'm probably holding them to a higher standard than I otherwise might not. And so, as an example, just today, our older son had kind of like a like an infection on his close to his fingernail from picking at it, right? And it kind of puffed up. Now I know from experience that, like, he's probably gonna go have to have it lanced and all these different things. And I said to him at breakfast this morning, I said, look, I never want to see you go through pain. However, when you go to the doctor, if they have to lance it or give you a shot, it's going to hurt. And so my hope is that the pain is just enough to teach you that your decision led to that and that you can prevent it. A little harsh for a 7 year old, probably, but I also want him to see the connection between, and I say him, but also our younger son, 4. To see the connection between their decisions and actions and the outcomes and consequences. And another example might be when most of these are with our older son, because he's more I don't know the child psychology term, but he's just more, not independent, but he's more of a,
He's going to try things. He's a doer. He's going to experience some things that might lead to some decisions, right? Where he has to really evaluate.
yeah, he's developing some logic, right? And so, like, the other night, it was so they were off of school yesterday for President's Day, and so he said, can I, every now and then we'll let him come watch TV, after they've gone to bed. And he said, can I come watch TV? And I said, yes, but wait for me to come get you, don't just come down, Well, what does he do? He comes downstairs. And so I said, look, you can't watch TV now. And he's like, well, why not? I'm like, because I told you to wait and you decided that you didn't want to. So he's very upset, right? And so now I'm like, all right, do I console them? Do I stay hard on them? So I did a bit of both, and I consoled them, but I was like, look, generally speaking, when you're upset, when you get hurt, it's because you didn't listen to us. And so I want him to understand that, and he won't, because it's like me, stubborn, right? But I would like for him to understand that that there's always going to be a direct relationship between his choices and actions, and kind of what happens. And even on top of that, I tell them that you might do everything right and things still won't go your way. And not just with us, but even more so in the out in the world. And and then I think on the other side of that is, because having had the experiences that I've had professionally, I also know when I usually in the moment I say something that's just stupid and just unreasonable for somebody their age, I'll be like, damn, I shouldn't have said it like that, or something, right? And from recovery, I've learned to apologize in as soon as I can. And another time was when our older son was bragging, oh no, he was giving his little brother a hard time about something. And they're both kind of wrapping up basketball season. I said to him, I said, well, you can't even rebound. And he kind of got upset or annoyed with me calling him out. And then I had this thought, probably sooner than later, but I had this thought later that that was a really just asshole thing of me to say, because the reason he can't rebound is because I haven't spent enough time teaching him. And so it was about 11 o'clock when I had this kind of thought, and I went into his room and woke him up, and I said, hey, I'm sorry for saying that. This is on me. And I think for me, it's been important to, apologies have been very important in our home, because my parents, they have apologized, to things, or for things, I should say, but definitely not right in the moment or soon after, right? It was like, on some discussion some years later or what have you. And then even another instance when, someone close to our older son had disappointed him and did not apologize for it. And so that was a moment also where I could say to him, like, not everybody is going to be willing or even ready to apologize, even if they know that they're wrong. I said, and it's not fair, but who you are as a person does not depend on whether or not they apologize. And gosh, just the other day, he came into my office here, and he was asking about drugs at 7, and he had watched a profile on one of his favorite NFL players and like a family thing that they had. And he's like, "What are drugs?" And so that prompted a good 15-20 minute discussion, and I actually told him some about my past. And just my, choices and what they led to. And it's like, why do people use drugs? And I was like, man, these questions are tough, right? And so I think I at the time I said, it usually starts off in a peer group, with our friends, and it's like we're just trying to have fun. I said, I think the underlying motivator for anybody to I didn't say state of mind, because that's a little, academic sounding for him, right? I said, but we want to feel good, especially when we're sad or angry. And so we turn to things that help, that we think make us feel good. But really what it is that we're just not secure with who we are, and we may not feel comfortable in our relationships to talk about what's bothering us. And then that led me to also talk about friends that I've lost, like someone that I mentioned earlier. And so it was just a very cool opportunity to have that discussion with him, to ideally gain an understanding of human thought patterns and processes.
So many things that you're saying are so critical that I love that you're speaking to. One, power of repair, that apology in all of our relationships, so critical to heal those fractures that we have. And then you're going to listen to this. You're going to give yourself a hard time about some of the things you're saying, Marcel. And what I'm here to tell you is the power of relationship when we're teaching our kids consequences, actions, effect, cause and effect. Relationships hugely important, and you're not teaching your lessons to your kids without relationship. They're in relationship with you, and that's beautiful. It's such a gift that you're giving your children. And then the one thing I'm learning about your son that I think might be similar to you is he's going to need some reps. He's going to need a
Oh, for
lot of
sure.
repetitions, right? And so stubborn is about repetition. Stubborn's about like, oh, repetition to learn that or to achieve that or to get that done. And I love that you're sharing all those stories because I can tell those pieces that you've learned professionally influence your parenting, influence your relationship. And my experience with the professionals that we work with, meet, love, the ones who are living the work in their home are doing amazing work professionally. It's really hard for me to fall in love with professionals who aren't also building that home in what they're doing professionally as well. So I appreciate you taking the time to share all of that with us.
Thank you. And as you were saying that, I was thinking how probably an area I struggle with articulating is when our children get upset of a consequence. Like, they keep doing something that we told them not to do, and then so either something gets taken away or they just don't get their way, and so they get upset, and I jump into, you're not gonna feel sorry for yourself. Because like you knew going into this what would happen because you were warned. It was kind of an escalation type thing, right? And I think I overemphasize that portion because I know for me, in addiction, it's like the self-pity piece. And the self-pity to me always leads to larger resentments or resentments longer over time and all these different things. And even though I know that I can't and shouldn't shield our children from the hardships of the world, I also would like for them to have some information of what they're going to confront and how to navigate that. And so for me, self-pity is just a big one because I know that I'm projecting at times unnecessarily, but they ought to know that there is a relationship between self-pity and just destructive behavior.
You are just showing up for your kids in all the ways that they need a dad and a father. And I love that. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about Be About Change, about Tucker's House, about your family, but mostly just about you, Marcel. You are a gift on this planet. And I'm so glad that I have gotten to cross paths with you.
Well,
Thanks for
thank you,
being with me
Stacy.
today. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. How can people find you if they're like, ah, I need more? Or I have millions of dollars I want to donate to Marcel's projects. Yeah, how do these beautiful humans who are listening find you and reach out?
So the best one would be Marcel, Marcel, at beaboutchange.org, and also Marcel.hernandez at tuckershouse.org. And that's whether, program or community partner or questions in general. Email probably be best. And then I tend to set up appointments like you and I have now, or phone calls or in-person meetings.
Love that. Thank you for your time today, Marcel. I'm so, so thankful for you.
Thank you, Stacy.
Have a good day.
You too.